to the bathroom.
I'm uneasy about his parentage, of course, but no matter who they were, he did save your life.
Yes, indeed, says my father. We want to know everything about your Cassidy.
Chapter 31. Bryn. While I get dressed, my father opens up his laptop and learns that Millinocket doesn't have a town hall, but it does have a town office that is open today from 9 until 4. My mother sets up our breakfast in the living room, and we eat quickly, anxious to get started. The hotel where my parents are staying is the best in the area, but it isn't directly in town, so it's a bit of a drive back over to Penobscot Avenue, and I am jittery with a combination of anticipation and nerves. I don't know why I feel so strongly that the clock is ticking down on Cassidy's and my chance for a happy ending, but I do. In his note, Cassidy warned me not to come looking for him. It won't be easy for me to find him anyway, hidden as he is. I will need to look at maps of the area and recall everything he told me about where we were located in order to piece together a general location. That said, if he truly believes he's a danger to me, and in an effort to keep me safe from him, I can imagine him picking up and leaving. Maybe not forever, but Cassidy knows how to fend for himself. I suppose he could live in the Maine wilderness for years undetected. I am frightened of losing my window to find him again. It hurts that he wouldn't share his history with me. I am so in love with him, but we were also friends. I wish he had trusted me. I wish he had known that he could trust me, because I saw the colors of his heart and I loved them all. But for someone as broken as Cassidy, I will need to prove it. And that's exactly what I intend to do. Show him how much I love him. No matter who his parents were, it doesn't change my feelings for him, and it doesn't change my dreams for a future with him.
Here we are, Bug,
says my dad, pulling into a parking spot. To my surprise, I'm back where I found myself earlier this morning, at the Millinocket Police Department. The police station?
Town clerk's located in the front of the building.
We leave the car, enter the brick building, and find the correct office on the first floor to the left. An older woman looks up from a reception desk.
Afternoon.
Hi, I say, holding out my hand. I'm Bryn Cadogan.
Hi there, Janice Dolby,
she says, shaking my hand and darting a glance to my mom and dad. These are my parents, Colin and Jenny.
Pleased to know you,
she says, standing up and shaking their hands in turn. I was wondering if you keep a log or a ledger of some kind of birth records?
You mean birth certificates?
No, I'm specifically looking for... I scan her face, deciding to go a different route. Ma'am, have you lived a long time here in Millinocket?
62 years,
she says proudly.
Born and raised.
Do you remember the Porters? She raises her eyebrows, her expression closing.
Are you reporters?
No, ma'am, I say. But I am curious about Cassidy Porter.
He was found dead, you know, in June?
Yes, ma'am, I nod, lifting my t-shirt enough to show my healing wounds. I know. I was his victim.
Oh, my,
she gasps, looking at my scars, then back at my face.
Land's sake, you're the missing girl.
Yes, ma'am.
Our Bryn was saved by a man who lives up in the woods,
shares my father.
You don't say.
Yes, I nod. And I know this is going to sound strange, but the man who saved me was also called Cassidy Porter. Her eyes widen.
My goodness.
Ma'am, were there two Cassidy Porters born in Millinocket? Two Cassidy Porters living here?
No,
she says.
No, not that I recall. Only one. Little Cassidy with different colored eyes.
My stomach drops, because she's definitely talking about my Cass, not Wayne, and I nod for her to continue.
Him and his mama moved away soon after the trial. Never saw them again.
Never? She shakes her head.
His grandfather, Cleary, Frank Cleary would come into town from time to time to collect his check from the government. He was injured over in Vietnam, don't you know? But I don't much remember seeing Cassidy.
Where did his grandfather Cleary live?
Lord only knows, she answers, shaking her head and sighing. Folks said he built a cabin way up in the North Woods and lived there. It kept to himself. He owned over 2,000 acres up against Baxter Park.
My eyes widen in disbelief.
2,000 acres? She nods. I can show you the survey from the sale if you want.
I nod eagerly, and she gestures to a 4-person table in the center of the room.
Take a seat. It's quiet today. I'll see what I can dig up.
As we sit down, I notice my dad's eyebrows scrunched up, like he's figuring something out in his head.
Bryn, he says, that's a lot of land.
I know, I say, but actually I don't have a very good idea of how much it is. My father breaks it down.
I'm not positive how much land up here costs, but I'm going to guess it's around $600 an acre, which means your Cassidy is sitting on well over $1 million worth.
Whoa. Here we go, says Ms. Dolby, holding a dog-eared manila folder. Was filed right there under C for Cleary.
She opens it on the table, unfolding a map tucked inside and smoothing it with her palms.
Yep. 2,160 acres abutting Baxter State Park bought for $135,000 back in 1972, sold to Francis and Bertram Cleary.
She pauses, humming softly, then grabs a post-it note.
Need to contact Mr. Cleary, Bert, that is. Let him know that the land's vacant now that Cassidy's passed.
I'm about to say that it isn't vacant and Cassidy hasn't passed, but I'm not sure what claim my Cassidy has to Cleary land, so I swallow my words. If he's not related to the Clearys by blood, he may have no claim to that land at all. Ms. Dolby, I say, is there any chance I could get a copy of this map? She glances at my hip, where I showed her the scars from my attack, gives me a sympathetic look and shrugs.
Can't hurt anything, I guess.
She takes the file and trudges off with it, presumably to a copy machine.
Why do you need the survey?
Whispers my mother across the table.
I need to study it to try to figure out where Cassidy's cabin is located. You don't know?
She asks, seeming surprised. I shake my head.
I don't. He carried me there from Katahdin, and once I was there, I never left except to go to a local pond. When you were driven here to town this morning, you didn't see anything.
I haven't wanted to think about this very much, but I am fairly certain that Cassidy drugged me so that I'd stay asleep during the drive this morning. It accounts for the bruising headache I had when I woke up, in addition to vomiting in the police station. The thing is, I understand why he did it. He didn't want to fight with me about leaving, and he didn't want me to know how to get back. That said, I'm not sure my mother would understand, so I keep it to myself. I was asleep the whole time.
You don't sleep that deeply, Bryn. The doorbell wakes you up.
I sprained my wrist last night, I explain, cobbling together a feasible story. I took a painkiller before bed. Must have knocked me out. I am saved from having to say any more by the return of Ms. Dolby, who puts a finger in front of her lips and slides a copy of the survey map to me. I wink at her, fold it up, and hand it to my mother, who stuffs it in her purse.
Did you have any other questions about Cassidy?
She asks, glancing at the front desk, which remains quiet. I do. I take a deep breath. Could we look up his birth date? She sits down at the table with us.
Don't need to. Cassidy Porter was born on the same weekend as the Great White Easter Storm of 1990. Won't never forget it. We got 36 feet in 48 hours. Sunday, April 15th, 1990.
My goodness, says my mother. What a memory you have.
More deaths than births that weekend.
Ms. Dolby shakes her head sadly.
Including my youngest son, Willie.
Oh, no,
gasps my mother, reaching across the table to take Ms. Dolby's hand and squeeze it. Ms. Dolby sniffles.
It was the spring thaw, don't you know? He went up Katahdin after church on Sunday morning with a friend, aiming to be home by supper. No one knew we were getting that kind of snow a few hours later. Those boys were wearing shorts and t-shirts when they left. Didn't have anything they needed for a whiteout like that. Got caught in it and never made it down.
I'm so sorry, I say.
I thought we'd lost Bryn on Katahdin, my mother says. I hate that mountain.
Don't hate the hill, says Ms. Dolby, patting my mother's hand. Ain't its fault that fools want to climb it.
She darts a glance to me.
No offense, miss.
None taken, I say. She releases my mother's hand and turns to me.
Weren't many born that weekend, if memory serves. Cassidy Porter, of course, and the preacher's son. Hard to forget that. Preacher's wife, Nora, broke her bag of waters in the middle of Jesus Christ is Risen Today, like a waterfall all over the first pew. Her friend gave her a ride to the hospital while Pastor Wayne finished up the service.
Pastor Wayne? My blood runs cold, and I blink at her in shock.
What did you say? What was the pastor's name?
Jackson Wayne.
Oh, my God.
Ms. Dolby continues.
Pastor Wayne finished the sermon and stayed for coffee afterward because it was Easter and all, and everyone knows first-time labor takes an age. Walked over to his house to change clothes about noon, but by the time he was ready to follow Nora to the hospital, the snow was falling at a clip. Roads impassable. I don't think he saw baby Jackson until Tuesday morning.
Jackson Wayne, I murmur. Pieces of a massive puzzle snapping together in my head as I flash back to the first time I met Wayne. They call me Wayne. I know this mountain. I'm a local, born over in Millinocket. I could help you.
Jackson Wayne, Jr. Called him J.J., says Ms. Dolby, tapping on her chin in thought.
Strange occurrence in retrospect.
Why is that?
Well, the son of the Methodist pastor and the son of a serial killer born on the same night in the same place during one of the worst storms of the century.
Jackson Wayne, Jr., I say, feeling breathless. J.J., he was the pastor's son? She looks up at me and sighs.
Oh my, you'd never know it. He was a real hellraiser.
Her face sours.
You know what they say about pastors' kids, right?
Well, this one was the worst I ever seen.
How so? She shakes her head like she's warding off a bad memory.
Lots of animals went missing in the Wayne's neighborhood. Kids bloodied up, scared like the devil was chasing them by the time they got home, but wouldn't say who done it. J.J. was always in trouble, but his parents were such good people no one knew what to do. He was manipulative, don't you know, putting on one face for his parents and another for the world. Let's just say when the Waynes moved on to a parish down south, we were sorry to say goodbye to Jackson and Nora, but no one felt sad watching J.J. go.
I look at my father, sitting across from me, and he raises his eyebrows.
It would have been chaotic at the hospital that weekend.
That's the truth,
confirms Ms. Dolby, oblivious to the meaningful exchange between me and my father.
We got the I-95 interstate nearby. Folks out and about visiting kin for the holiday. Car crashes right and left. People slipping on the ice. Frostbite? It would have been a doozy.
We don't want to keep you from your work,
says my mother smoothly, patting Ms. Dolby's arm.
We are so terribly sorry about your son, about Willie.
Ms. Dolby nods.
He was a good boy, only 15 when I lost him that Easter day.
I'm very sorry, says my father.
We all stand up, shaking Ms. Dolby's hand to say goodbye, when I ask, you said the Waynes moved on, but did they keep any property here?
Yep, now that you mention it, they did. A fishing cabin on a lake out by Katahdin. But I haven't seen any of them in town for 10 years at least. I wouldn't recognize JJ if I bumped into him. She shivers. That child always gave me the creeps. Something... oh, I don't know. Off about him, I suppose. You ever met anyone like that? A little off?
Yes, I nod at her retreating form. Yes, I have. My father takes my arm, leading me and my mother back out of the room and into the hallway.
Switched at birth,
whispers my mother. I gulp, because it is at once outlandish and obvious.
How is that possible?
I ask. My father sighs.
Unexpected blizzard on a holiday? Chaotic hospital. People traveling to visit family. Car wrecks. Power outages. The two little babies born under such circumstances. Anything could have happened.
Come on, I tell them, beelining for the front door.
Where now?
Asks my mother.
The hospital.
When we arrive at Millinocket General Hospital, we follow the signs to the information desk.
Afternoon, says the young woman sitting at the desk. Here for visiting hours?
No, says my dad, surprising me by stepping forward and grinning warmly.
Actually, we're trying to solve a little bit of a mystery.
Is that right?
Asks the receptionist, smiling up at my dad. He's always been charming.
Yes, indeed. My daughter here, Bryn, was born in this very hospital back in 1987.
Oh, my! Welcome back!
We were traveling down from Portage Lake, where we have a summer house, when my wife...
My father puts an arm around my mother and pulls her against his side.
Went into labor. Well, I pulled off the highway, and thank God this hospital was here waiting for us.
Amen,
offers the receptionist. My father chuckles and nods.
Amen, indeed.
Then what?
Well, we were here for 2 nights and had the most amazing nurse look after us. And you know, all these years later, here we are, back up in this neck of the woods, and thought we'd take a chance on swinging in and saying thank you to her.
Oh my gosh, that is so, so, so sweet.
My father leans his elbow on the counter and gives her the 1,000-megawatt smile that used to win all of his toughest court cases.
Do you think you could give us a hand?
Of course, she says, grinning conspiratorially at each of us. What can I do?
Do you know the name of the nurse up in maternity who's been here for...
like 100 years?
Just 30, dear.
Betty Landon's been here for a long while, says the receptionist.
You sure now? Asks my dad. Betty. Betty does feel right,
the young woman whispers.
She delivered my mama, and she's 38.
Then Betty's our gal, says my dad.
She's here today. Want me to see if she's free to come down and say a quick hello?
Aw, he says. Would you?
Sure.
I watch as the receptionist picks up the phone, asks to speak with Betty, relates our story, and smiles at my dad triumphantly.
You all go sit over there at that table. I'll send her over when she gets down here, okay?
Who's the best?
Asks my dad.
Me?
She asks him with a giggle. He nods, pointing at her with both index fingers.
You.
My mother takes my arm and leads me to the table, smothering a chuckle.
He's incorrigible.
You're lucky he's devoted to you, I say.
Yes,
she says, squeezing me tighter.
And to you.
We sit down, and my dad joins us a second later.
More bees with honey, huh?
You could charm the whole hive, I say. A moment later, an older black woman stops by the reception desk, then looks in our direction, smiling at us as she approaches the table and stands behind the only open chair.
I'm Betty Landon. I understand you're looking for me.
Ms. Landon, I say, standing up. Will you join us for a minute? She nods, sitting down in the chair and straightening her light blue cardigan.
Chilly down here. We keep it warm up there for the little ones, don't you know?
Of course, says my mother.
You wanted to talk to me,
asks Betty, looking at my dad.
Under false pretenses, I'm afraid, says my father. Bryn?
I wasn't born here, I say, feeling a little bad when Ms. Landon's smile fades. But I don't mean any harm. I just had a couple of questions, and I was hoping you could help me. She clears her throat, leaning away from us, her eyes wary.
Questions about what?
There were two babies born here on Sunday, April 15th, 1990. Jackson Wayne Jr. and Cassidy Porter. Is there any chance you were working that night?
The Great White Easter Storm,
she says, sitting back in her seat. She takes a deep breath and nods.
Bad time. Yes, I was here, I remember.
Bad time, I ask.
No trucks could get through for days.
She shakes her head again.
If the injured could get here, we helped them. But the staff that was here when the storm hit was trapped. We stayed for, oh, I think it was 3 straight days.
That must have been exhausting, my mother observes.
Very,
says Ms. Landon. I reach for her hand, desperate to find out what I can about Jackson and Cassidy. Those two little boys, they were born that Sunday.
Yes, I remember we had two boys born during that storm, because later they found two local boys dead up on Katahdin, and everyone said that nature had balanced itself out.
I know she's talking about Willie Dolby and his friend, and I flinch with the terribleness of platitudes. After a breath, she continues.
I wasn't present at either birth. I was minding a little un in the NICU that was struggling. He didn't make it either.
I'm sorry, I say, waiting a beat before asking, do you remember who else was working that night, that weekend? Specifically, who would have been involved in delivery?
Would have been,
she nods, her lips turning down. Who? Who was here?
Well, Dr. Gordon and Dr. Maxwell.
I get the feeling we haven't come to the, yet. Who else?
Nurse Humphreys. Teresa Humphreys. She was the nurse on duty that night. Head nurse of maternity, in fact. She stayed all 3 days.
Do you mind my asking why you said, that way when you remembered her? Ms. Landon sighs, looking up at me with sad eyes.
She's gone now, of course. She was almost 70 back then.
Was there something troubling about Nurse Humphreys?
Why are you asking about these boys?
She counters, her face growing cool.
Because I really need to get back to what...
Is it possible they were switched? I blurt out. Is it possible that at some point between their birth and discharge that the babies were switched? Her eyes widen, and she shakes her head, pushing her chair away from the table and standing up.
I'm sorry, folks, but nursing unions don't look kindly on those types of conversations. I need to head back upstairs.
I stand too, reaching for her arm, which I hold gently. Please, Ms. Landon, I can't begin to tell you how desperately I need this information. I'm begging you. The nurse looks at me, her eyes conflicted. She leans close to me, her voice soft.
Teresa Humphreys died in May 1990. Look into it.
She offers me a sad smile, turns, and leaves. I need the internet, I think, as I leave the table and head to the car without a word, my parents following at my heels asking about Betty Landon's parting words. Wait for me, Cass. I'm coming, my love. I promise you, I'm coming.
Chapter 32. Cassidy. Dropping off Bryn at the Millinocket Police Department was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. But now that I know the truth about myself, that I hurt people like my father did, that I am a killer like him, I take some small comfort in the notion that I got her away from me in time. It's the only comfort left in my wretched life, now that I have lost Bryn. I had a long 2-hour drive to think about Wayne, and I can't say I'm sorry for killing him, which bothers me a lot. Taking a human life would tear apart a good man. But I'm not a good man. I don't care that I killed him. Truth told, I'd kill him 100 times if it meant keeping my Bryn safe. But my stark lack of regret, of any shred of guilt or remorse, worries me. I took a human life. Shouldn't I feel bad about that? That I don't feels like another step into the hell that is my transformation into Paul Isaac Porter, another indicator that the change has begun. When I get home, the sun is rising, but I can't bear to witness its glory. I park the ATV in its stall, then climb off, stumbling blindly into Annie's adjacent stall. I am home, and Bryn is gone. And I will never love or be loved again. I slump down the wall onto the hay, pull my knees to my chest and lower my head, letting my rage and fear and sorrow and sheer exhaustion roar up from within me in endless bellows of fury. I scream and yell, my worthless heart bleeding out in the darkest corner of my miserable world. I scare Annie half to death, and she bleats her worry until I stop, curling into a ball by my side and crying like a baby, my body shuddering with sobs until I finally fall asleep. When I wake up, it's late afternoon. Annie needs to be milked, and the girls need to be fed. Otherwise, the place can go to hell. I don't care about it anymore. Anywhere I look, I'll see Bryn now. I'll remember her smiles and sighs, the way she hummed the Beatles and giggled at me, the way her sweet body curved into mine, so trusting, and the way she said she loved me. For a sweet, short moment, she filled my bleak, sorry, unworthy life with color and tenderness. This homestead, which was once my sanctuary, then my heaven, is my hell now. I can't bear to stay. Not that it's even an option. I need to move on. Immediately. I'm a murderer now. The murdering son of a serial killer. It's only a matter of time until they come for me, and when they do, there's no way in hell they'll believe I killed that guy accidentally. They'll take one look at my last name, and I'll be sent to prison. Unless I run. I'm going to pack up what I need, including the rest of Gramps' paper money, and I'm heading north. It's still July, which means I have 2 months of fair weather. I should be able to find a new place to build my own cabin. 4 walls with a makeshift fireplace and chimney by the end of September. I'll wait out the winter, killing whatever I need to survive. A moose for meat, a bear for its skin, geese for their fat and feathers. I've never killed mammals before. But what does it matter now? I've killed a man, a human being. I've given up the only woman who could ever love me. I feel dead inside. The moral code I lived with all my life may as well be dead, too. As far as Annie and the girls go, I can either pack them up on my ATV and drop them off at the store, or I can set them free, knowing they probably won't be able to fend for themselves in the wild for more than a day or two. They were my only friends before Bryn. I owe them more than death at the claws of a bobcat or a black bear, so I decide to take them into town tonight. I'll tie up Annie at the store entrance. I'll leave the girls in a covered crate by the door. Hopefully the people who work there will find homes for them. At least they'll have a shot at survival. I don't want to risk being seen, so I'll leave at 1 a.m., when the world is darkest. In the meantime, I can get myself ready to go, to leave this place behind. Annie nudges me with her head, bleeding softly, and I grab the metal bucket from the wall, placing it under her teeth and kneeling beside her. I'll take you to the store later, I tell her. I'm sure someone there will find a home for you. Hope so. The only sound is the patter of milk hitting the metal bucket. I let Bryn go. I confess to Annie, my heart still beating, even though it's dying. I had to. I'm no good for her. I hope no one bothered her. I hope a kind police officer woke her up and helped her figure out where she was. I debated leaving the note pinned to her shirt, but in the end I decided to do it. I know how hard it was for her to say goodbye to Jem. She's the sort of woman who loves long and hard, and if I didn't at least attempt to give her some closure, she might waste time grieving us. I hope my note tells her just enough to let me go and gives her a jump start moving on from our month together. A month? It only took a month to change my entire life. When it started, I was lonesome, but I knew who I was. Now, I know what it is to love someone. I know what it is to be loved in return, And I know that I'm turning into a monster, just like I always feared. I'm not one for self-pity, but damn if I don't feel a little sorry for myself right this minute. I wasn't born to a happy fate, I know that. But how I longed for it. And with Bryn, I almost tricked myself into believing that it was possible. But it wasn't. It was never possible. The sons of murderers don't deserve to be happy. They are born paying for the sins of their fathers. I finish up with Annie and take the bucket of milk outside, dumping it into the woods. No need for it anymore, since I'll be leaving sometime tomorrow. I usually take the bucket, rinse it out, and put it back on the hook in the barn, but there's no point in doing that either, so I drop-kick it away. Walking toward the cabin, I keep my head down until I get to the steps, stupidly hoping to avoid memories of Bryn as I step up onto the porch. But she is everywhere. I see her in the rocking chair, naked under a blanket, holding a cup of tea as the sun rises over Katahdin. I see her nestled on my lap, her hair tickling my throat as we watch the sunset together. I hear her sigh when I catch her peeking at me while I chop wood, and licking her lips to tell me she wants another kiss. I open the door and step inside, and there she is again, watching the sandlot beside me on the couch, walking through the living room barefoot, her small feet soft on the carpet. She's in the kitchen, rinsing dishes and frying brook trout and turning to smile at me from the stove. She's choosing a book from the shelves under the window, and she's jumping into my arms to cover my face with kisses, and she's nowhere. A choking sob explodes from my throat, and I grab the first thing I see. Gramps' wooden walking stick leaning by the front door, and I attack the room. I smash little knick-knacks that belong to my mother and overturn the coffee table with my foot. I throw a lamp and hardcover books into the plate glass windows until they shatter, and then I pulverize larger chunks of glass into tiny shards by beating them with the stick. I stalk into the kitchen and throw chairs against the cabinets, destroying both. I lift the table and hurl it into the living room, watching as two legs snap off when it crashes down on the upside-down coffee table. I hate this house where I have hidden for most of my life. It will never, ever be a home again. Panting with exertion, I throw the walking stick away from me and brace my hands on the sink, bowing my head as a desperate, keening noise rises from my throat. My body shakes with a sorrow so profound and so complete, I can't think of a single reason to keep on living. Bryn is everywhere. Bryn is nowhere. I am lost.
Chapter 33. Bryn. When we get back from the hospital, it's afternoon, and I ask my father if I can use his laptop to do some research. He sits with my mom in the living room of the suite, watching TV, while I open the doors to the deck overlooking Ferguson Lake and do a little cyber investigating of my own. I am almost certain that Cassidy Wayne Porter and Jackson Wayne Jr. were switched at birth, but while I know for certain that Wayne was the son of Paul Isaac and Rosemary Cleary Porter, I don't have any proof that Cassidy, my Cass, is the son of Jackson and Nora Wayne. I need that proof before I return to him. My wrist bothers me as I type, but nothing's getting in the way of my search. I take an Advil, powering through the ache of the sprain. I start with Teresa Humphreys, searching the web for any information I can find on her. An obituary comes up readily in the North Country Register. Teresa Dario Humphreys was born in Bangor and moving to Millinocket with her husband, Gabe, in 1962. She worked as head nurse in the maternity ward of Millinocket General Hospital until April 30, 1990, and died on May 22, 1990. I pause here for a moment, looking at the dates carefully and wishing the obituary offered more information about the cause of death. She retired only 22 days before she died? Was she sick? Or was it a coincidence that the two events were so close together? Frustrated, I scan the rest of the obituary quickly, my eyes locking on the very last sentence. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations are made in Mrs. Humphrey's name to the National Brain Tumor Foundation. My lips part as I reread the short sentence, and Betty Landon's warning returns to me. Teresa Humphreys died in May 1990. Look into it. A brain tumor. Teresa Humphreys must have had a brain tumor, and Betty Landon knew it. I open a new internet session and type in brain tumor symptoms. The Mayo Clinic lists several symptoms for a brain tumor, including headaches and nausea, which Teresa Humphreys could have explained away as one of 1,000 other benign conditions. But the most troubling symptom for me is confusion in everyday matters. For someone like Nurse Humphreys, who'd been trusted with the lives of babies for almost 3 decades, caring for infants would have been an everyday matter. But switching them on an especially chaotic evening could have been a result of confusion. It's a small victory, and makes my baby-switching theory more plausible, but I still don't have proof. How could I get proof? I wonder. That's what I need before I go to Cassidy with all this information. Cold, hard proof that he's not Paul Isaac Porter's son. Opening up a new internet window, I type in Nora and Jackson Wayne. If the Waynes were willing to give a DNA sample that could be compared to Cassidy's, I could get definitive proof. A webpage for the United Methodist Church of Windsor, Rhode Island comes up immediately, and I click on it, leaning forward in my seat. A New England-style white clapboard church decorates the home page, and I click on the About tab, then on the Our Ministry Team tab. And when Pastor Jackson Wayne's face comes up on the screen, I gasp. Sudden tears blur my vision as my fingers rise from the keys to trace the lines of Jackson Wayne Sr.'s face. It is Cassidy's face 30 years from now. The blonde hair is white, and the skin is weathered, but this face is a carbon copy of my Cass's, right down to the 3 mesmerizing moles on the pastor's left cheek. "Oh my God," I murmur, staring back at an aged version of the face I love more than any other in the world, something galvanizing within me. I have 0 doubts in my mind that Pastor Wayne is Cassidy's biological father, and if there is no other way to prove it, I will drive down to Rhode Island myself. But that would take a full day away from getting back to Cassidy, when I was hoping to scour the survey map this afternoon and evening for an approximate location of his cabin. My father has already rented me an ATV tomorrow from the Golden Bridge store that Cassidy mentioned once or twice. Before frustration gets the better of me, I remember that I never did see birth records for the 2 boys. Maybe I can start there tomorrow. In the meantime, I need to go downstairs to the Hotel Business Center and print everything out. Information about the 1990 storm, Nurse Humphrey's obituary, and this picture of Pastor Jackson Wayne. Tomorrow, I'll stop by the police station and ask Marty or Lou for a copy of the DNA report proving that Cassidy Porter was the name of my attacker. I still need solid proof that my Cassidy was born Jackson Wayne Jr., but I feel like I'm getting closer. Wait for me, Cass. I'm coming. I am at the town clerk's office at 9 o'clock on the dot the next morning with my growing folder of information, and to my great relief, Ms. Dolby is working at the desk again. Today, I'm hoping to get copies of Teresa Humphreys' death certificate, plus birth certificates for Cassidy Porter and Jackson Wayne Jr. I have looked up the requirements for requesting duplicates of such documents, and technically I am supposed to be related to these people in order to ask for their vital records. However, Ms. Dolby was so helpful and sympathetic yesterday, I am desperately hoping she will prove as amenable today. Her warm smile tells me I might just get lucky.
Miss Cadogan, you're looking well this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Dolby. Please call me Bryn.
Well then, you're looking well, Bryn.
She raises her eyebrows.
What can I do for you today?
I decide not to beat around the bush. I was hoping to get copies of the birth certificates of Jackson Wayne Jr. and Cassidy Porter.
Hmm.
she says, pursing her lips. Cassidy Porter ain't a problem, 'cause he's dead, but Jackson Wayne Jr., I don't know, you ain't kin, are you? I take a deep breath. What if I was? Well, then, I couldn't stand in the way of you seeking out your kin, could I? She answers shrewdly. I smile. Miss Dolby, I'm looking for the birth records of my cousins, Jackson Wayne Jr. and Cassidy Porter. Also, if possible, the death record of my aunt, Teresa Humphreys. She nods at me.
Just fill out this form, Bryn. I'll go make copies for you.
I fill out the form, checking cousin, cousin, and aunt on the records, and wait against the counter for Ms. Dolby to return with the copies. The birth certificates will show that the boys were born on the same day, and Teresa Humphrey's death certificate should show that she died of a brain tumor, corroborated by the detail in the obituary. My next stop will be the police station to get a copy of the DNA test on Cassidy Porter, and then I need my parents to drive me to the Golden Bridge store where I will collect my ATV. My father and I spent about 2 hours leaning over the survey map last night, and if my calculations are correct, it's about 14 miles to Harrington Pond from the store. I was there twice. I'm going to circle the pond, looking for Bryn's Rock, and try to walk from there to Cassidy's homestead by memory. And then? Oh, God. My heart races. And then I'll share everything I've learned and hope against hope that our story is just beginning.
Here you are now,
says Ms. Dolby, placing the three documents on the counter.
Was there anything else?
No. Thank you, I say, sliding the papers into my manila file folder. Thank you so much for helping me.
You didn't even look at them,
she says. I will, but they're more for someone else than for me.
Hmm,
she hums.
Curious note on JJ's birth certificate. Never noticed it before.
I search her eyes before flipping open the file. The first document is Teresa Humphrey's death certificate, and just as I thought, the cause of death is listed as a brain tumor. If she died only 3 weeks after her retirement, she probably had been making mistakes for weeks, if not months. No wonder Nurse Landon didn't want to talk about it. But I silently thank her in my heart for leading me in the right direction. I flip to the next document, the birth record for Cassidy Porter. I review the names of his parents, the location, date, and time of his birth, and his gender and race. Everything looks to be in order, and the document is signed by Elias Maxwell, M.D. My fingers tingle as I flip to the final document, the birth record of Jackson Wayne Jr., also signed by Elias Maxwell, M.D., placing it beside Cassidy Porter's for comparison. Names of parents? Check. Location, date, and time of birth, check, and almost identical to Cassidy Porter's. The boys were born 19 minutes apart, which only adds to the notion of a chaotic maternity ward. Gender, male. Race, Caucasian. Check, check. I squint, leaning closer to the photocopied document. Next to race, there is something else. A small scribbled note beside the word Caucasian? My lips part in amazement and relief as I realize it says congenital heterochromia iridis. Congenital heterochromia iridis, I breathe, looking up at Ms. Dolby with eyes no doubt as wide as saucers. She shrugs.
And ain't that the strangest thing? Because my memory's pretty good, and I remember Cassidy as the boy with different colored eyes, not JJ. Oh, well, getting old, I suppose.
She pats me on the hand as someone enters the office behind me.
You take care now, Bryn.
I turn away from her, feeling my smiles start in my toes, which curl into the rubber bottoms of my flip-flops. That feeling of elation, of happiness and hope and grace rises from there, up my legs, to my belly, to my heart, to my head, and I stand there in the Millinocket town clerk's office with happy tears streaming down my face, grinning like I've just won the lottery. And I have. This is my proof. This birth certificate, signed by the doctor who delivered Jackson Wayne Jr., has a scrawled note detailing the unusual color of his eyes. Maybe because it was so rare, or maybe because he'd noticed that Nurse Humphreys was confused and needed a bit of extra information to tell the babies apart. I don't care why. I only care that it's there. I only care that it gives me and Cass a chance to be together.
"Sweetheart, are you sure you're up for this?" asks my mom after the owner of the Golden Bridge store explains how to work the top-of-the-line 2017 Outlander and gives me a helmet.
"You were up at the crack of dawn, and your wrist isn't healed yet. Let your father go instead."
I am already seated on the quad, but I look up at my mom, reaching for her hands.
"Thank you for everything. I can't wait for you to meet Cassidy."
"Bryn, please, let your father..."
"I love you, Mom,"
I say firmly, dropping her hands and putting on the helmet. "I'm going."
"You know where you're going, Bug,"
asks my dad, putting his hand on my shoulder.
"Not exactly,"
I say, shaking my head. Then I grin at him, and he hands me the manila folder, which I tuck into the side compartment. "More or less."
"It's noon. When do you think you'll get there?"
"Well, it took him about 3 hours to get to the store and back, so... I have no idea."
"You know where to go."
I look at the GPS my father picked up at the hardware store. It's strapped onto my wrist with Velcro, and we've loaded the coordinates that we believe correspond with the location of Harrington Pond. From what I can tell from Google Maps, it will be a smooth trip for about 10 miles, but there could be a little... what did Cass call it? Oh, yes, bushwhacking after that. I rev the motor like I was shown, looking up at my parents with a smile.
"Don't worry. See you tomorrow?"
My father puts his arm around my mother, holding her close as she wipes her eyes and nods.
"Be careful, Bug."
"We love you, Bryn. See you tomorrow."
I don't wave as I pull out of the parking lot and onto Golden Road. In fact, the wind in my face feels really good. My wrist isn't bothering me, thanks to 3 Advils, and I have always loved thinking while driving. I think about Cassidy. I think about him saving me from Wayne that day up on Katahdin and carrying me on his back to safety. I think about him sliding into bed beside me when I asked him to, holding me close all night long, and how I would wake up to him singing. I think about him hiking back up Katahdin to find Jem's phone, and how he chastised himself so harshly for being unable to find it. I think about him chopping wood without a shirt on, and chatting with Annie while he milked her, and fishing for brook trout on sunny days. I think about kissing him for the first time, cuddled up on the couch watching a movie together. I think about the way he looked at me, calling me his life's greatest treasure when he made love to me. I think that I will love Cassidy until the day I die, and I hope... oh, God, I hope so damned hard that he meant it when he wrote on that note that he loved me, too. I think that he deserves to know who he is, and I hope that by learning that he's the son of Nora and Jackson Wayne, it will release him from the terrible burden I suspect he's always carried. I think that one day I'd like to be his wife, and the mother of his children. I'd like to fall asleep every night with those strong arms around me and wake up every morning to those beautiful blue and green eyes. I think that if Cassidy is my future, I'll be the luckiest girl in the world. The voice on the GPS tells me to turn onto Telos Road, where I stay for 2 miles, chasing my thoughts away so I can concentrate on the drive. It's a double-lane dirt road for logging, I think, with thick forest on each side. I almost miss my next turn right onto a single lane path that's been used by other ATVs headed to Harrington Pond, which skirts the boundary of the Cleary land. I'm bumping along now, but nothing could make me turn back. I'm doing this. I'm almost there. I turn right again onto another dirt path, my heart thrumming with excitement to share everything I've learned with Cassidy. What will he say? What will he think? Will he believe me? And after I've shared everything with him, will there be a place for me in his life? Will he want to take a chance on us, to explore the possibility of building a life together? I hope so. Oh God, I hope so. Finally, I come to a fork in the road, and the GPS tells me to turn left to reach the pond, but there's no path in sight. Bushwhackin'. I look to my left, where there's nothing but thin woods and high grass. I take off my helmet for a second, idling at the end of the trail, and that's when I smell it. Smoke. Looking up, I realize that there's quite a lot of smoke, thick and gray, coming from somewhere ahead of me, a little off to the right. Wait. No! I cry as my mind quickly puts together that the only thing out here that could burn that big and that hot is Cassidy's home. Has he abandoned it? Or... A chilling thought makes my heart clench with agony. Could he somehow be trapped inside? No, please. Please, Cass, please wait for me. Please, I'm coming. It's a mantra as I jam the helmet back on my head and turn the bike in the direction of the billowing smoke. I have no idea what I'll find when I get there. I just pray I won't be too late.
Chapter 34. Cassidy. I packed up what I wanted, some clothes and food, rope and knives. Your rifle, Gramp, and the picture of us three, Mama. I took it out of the frame and rolled it up to keep it safe. I grabbed a few of my favorite books and Gramps' old guitar. I left Annie, the girls, and T-Rex at the store. I reckon they'll find homes for them. Hope so, anyway. I take a deep breath and sigh, looking in the direction of the homestead where smoke is rising thicker and darker. It's not that I wanted to live there anymore. I don't know how I would have borne it without Bryn. Heck, I couldn't stay even if I wanted to. Lord knows I need to be getting north, far away from this town, as soon as possible, before the sheriff comes knocking on my door, just as he came knocking on my father's. I look at the smoke again, feeling a little conflicted. Maybe because that homestead offered me sanctuary as a child, or because it was where Mama and Gramp died. It was my home for so long. Maybe it's just a bit of misguided sentiment. I look down at Gramps' grave marker. It was his place to do with what he wanted. All I did was carry out his wishes. I squat down beside the stone, gently pushing away the leaves. Then I lay my palm flat over it. Gramp, I burned it like you told me to. The house, the greenhouse, and the barn. It won't fall into the wrong hands now. No kids out here doing drugs. No government agencies coming out here to look around at what you built. You can rest easy, Gramp. I say, my voice breaking a little because I know I won't be back here for a long time, if ever. I took care of everything, just like you asked. I look over at the smoke again. It's been a wet summer and the nights are already cooling down into the high 40s. Situated as it is between Harrington and McKenna Ponds, the homestead should be a controlled burn and not rage into a wildfire. It was always part of Gramps' plan to burn it when he didn't need it anymore. And I find there's peace in carrying out his will. I pivot on my heels and face Mama's grave. Mama, I say, picturing her frizzy blonde hair and sweet blue eyes. I met someone. I blink rapidly as my mother's face is replaced by Bryn's. She was... I gulp. Everything to me. The breath I take is uneven and I inhale through my nose to keep from sniffling. But you were right to worry. I think I might be changing. So I let her go. Couldn't saddle her with someone like me. I place my palm flat on Mama's stone, as I did with Gramps's. I love her, Mama. I suspect I'll always love her, but I did what was right. I just want you to know that. After destroying the kitchen and living room last night, I packed up a few things in preparation for today. As long as I worked toward the goal of leaving, I allowed my mind to indulge in fantasy. I thought about Bryn's words. I want to be with you. I love you just the way you are. And her plan about getting a little place closer to town with lots of privacy. Read books and make love. Have a couple of kids. A merging of two lives that probably never should have collided into one. And damn if it doesn't make my heart ache like someone's driving a hammer into it, because I can't think of a better way to spend the rest of my life. Bryn, me, a place of our own, a family of our own. I burned all of my family's pictures, letters, and documents in the campfire. I punched a hole in the cistern and let the water drain out so it wouldn't douse the fire. I siphoned the diesel from the generator so I could use it this morning to get the fire started. When everything that needed to be done was finished, I lay my weary body down in the bed where my Bryn had slept, burying my face in her pillow. It still smelled of her, of us, and I thought again of what that sweet life in an alternate universe, in an alternate life, might have looked like. I knew one thing for certain. There would never be a man on the face of the earth as grateful as I would have been. And I would have lived every day of my life knowing I'd been pardoned. Knowing I'd been spared, knowing what it felt like to have a dark fate swapped with a bright and glorious future, knowing that I'd been blessed with grace. I went to sleep surrounded by memories of my Bryn, dreaming about a forever that could never be. Today I start over. I stand up from the graves, looking back and forth between them and knowing I might never be down this way again. Bye, Mama. Bye, Gramp. You did your best for me. And I will always be grateful for your care. I will always try to honor you. I will fight against it for as long as I can, but I promise, when the time comes, I will join you before I give in to being him. I take one last look at each of the stones and turn the ATV north.
Chapter 35. Bryn. When I arrive at the homestead, it's an inferno. Flames lick the structures of the barn and the cabin, and the roof has fallen in on both. I keep my distance, standing knee-deep in meadow grass and screaming Cassidy's name, my voice filled with terror and a sadness so profound, I don't know how I remain standing. Over and over, I scream his name until I am hoarse and exhausted, tears running down my face as I stare at the destruction of his home, a place where I rediscovered my will to live and met the love of my life. Cassidy! I shriek through sobs, knowing I'll never find him now that he's gone. I wish things were different. Come back! I scream, terrified that I have now lost a second man I loved. You are the greatest treasure of my entire life. Help! I wail to the sky, to the God who seems to have abandoned me again. You asked if I love you, and the answer is yes. Depleted of strength, I slump to the ground against a tree at the edge of the meadow, several yards from the burning house. I am limp and devastated, utterly spent after 2 days of racing against the clock. I bow my head, resting my forehead on my knees and weep, because I am at the end of the race now and I have lost. I have lost everything.
Angel, Bryn.
I hear his voice, urgent and panting, and I yank my head up to look at a man backlit by the sun, his strong body and wild hair instantly recognizable to me, even in silhouette. Cass? Oh, Cass, I murmur, but I don't trust myself. The vision is ethereal, and I am drained and bleary. I can't trust myself. I don't know if he's real. But suddenly he kneels before me, his mismatched eyes looking directly into mine. His hands reach for my unbandaged hand, gripping it gently but firmly between his. He brings it to his face, closing his eyes and pressing his lips to my fingers. And with that soft, familiar touch, I know it's him. It's my Cassidy. I launch myself against him, winding my arm around his neck and inhaling the goodness of him. Tears stream from my eyes as I feel his arms wrap around me and hold me close. He stands up, lifting me into his arms. I am being carried. My face is buried in the warm skin of his neck, and I won't let go. I don't care where he's going. I care only that we're together again, and I silently promise that I will never, ever let him go. No matter how long it takes to convince him, Cassidy will be my life's work, my heart's only desire.